The interview you're about to hear is not the first that I recorded in South Africa, but it's the one that just keeps running through my head because of the number of people that this entrepreneur is helping. So I'm going to put it out of order and have you listen to it first. And I should tell you that the only way I was able to get to South Africa to record interviews with entrepreneurs like this is that I got sponsored by ClickFunnels. At this point, I should be telling you how ClickFunnels helps you get strangers to give you their email addresses and then go on to purchase from you. But I'm not going to say any of that. Instead, I'm just going to say it's run by really good people who have helped me a lot over the years, who've created software that I use. And more than anything else, I appreciate how they're sponsoring my podcast and allowing me to go out and fly to meet people like the entrepreneur you're about to listen to. And if you want to go check them out, go to clickfunnels.com/Mixergy. You'll see why I love them and they'll give you some free time. But thank you, ClickFunnels. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Russell over at ClickFunnels for sponsoring Mixergy. And here's the interview without any sponsorship breaks in the middle. And then for the end of it, I thought we'd also say, once again, I want to thank my sponsor, ClickFunnels. And if you like this interview, you should know that I also flew out a while back to interview the founder of ClickFunnels, and you can hear my interview with him at clickfunnels.com/Mixergy.
Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses, and I do it for an audience of entrepreneurs. Joining me is someone who listened to my interviews, and I'm really excited that you got to see my stuff, that you know what it's about. I am so psyched to have you on here. Is it wrong for me to say more psyched about you than anyone else? No, that's absolutely wrong.
I'll take it.
You know why I'm excited about you? Your family's background. What you have done that literally is inspiring other entrepreneurs and showing them what's possible in Africa. And we'll let it unfold in the interview. It's also the good work that you're doing through entrepreneurship. So joining me is Aisha Pandor. She is the co-founder of Sweep South. It is Africa's first online platform for booking, managing, and paying for home cleaning services. I had no idea how well the business was doing. Frankly, I asked her to do an interview because she raised so much money. I figured these investors know what they're doing and everyone's talking about her. And then before we got started, she told me about the revenue. She told me about the business. It was exciting. Will you tell the audience what the revenue is?
So we don't typically talk about revenue, but what I can tell you is that we've had 15,000 women who've joined our platform who were previously unemployed or underemployed. And we're doing around 50,000 bookings a month through the platform.
50,000 bookings every month?
That's it. Going into 50,000 homes, 50,000 customers making bookings on the platform. And we feel like we've got a long, long way to go.
So I know the numbers. I'm not going to ask you any more questions. They're really impressive for a company that's how old?
5 years old.
5 years old. And it's all South Africa?
It's all South Africa for now. We are definitely looking at other markets. We're exploring Kenya with the aim of the launch early next year. Mm-hmm. And then we're also excited about the rest of the continent. Sweep South is an emerging market solution. So we want to help people who have services to provide in emerging markets to find customers who they can provide those services to. And so we're starting off on the African continent, but looking at South America, Southeast Asia, the UAE post that.
So the thing I wonder is, why are people paying month to month? You get to know the person who's cleaning your house. Why not say, hey, you know what, this whole Sweep South thing, it's been good for us. I'll give you money directly. We'll be done.
Well, I think that part of being a good business is being able to make sure that you're continuously providing value to the people who use your business, your company. So on the part of homeowners, there are a number of guarantees that we provide that keep people using the service. So the fact that this is an industry that has a high amount of turnover naturally anyways. So I go away on holiday, what happens to my domestic worker? There's some sort of issue with the relationship, which we do see that happens in the industry outside of our platform. You know, what happens then? Who's responsible? Who's accountable? We have insurance that covers breakages or damage. So there are a whole lot of guarantees that we provide that make sure that we add value.
They want the insurance in case something happens. And then also when the person moves on, they want to be able to find someone else.
A replacement who's vetted, who, you know, I don't need to go through the pain of trying to find someone else to step in.
So I want to find out how this company started and grew and how you got all these customers. But let me ask you a little bit more about this. When I got to the Hilton Hotel here in Cape Town, they literally made me sign something that said I would put my stuff in the safe. And I understood it's because maybe the cleaning people are going to steal, right? They don't want any.
They don't want to deal with the fact that that exists, so that, you know, and they're trying to help you not let that happen. And I think the unfortunate reality in South Africa at the moment is that we have very high levels of crime. The ability to have someone be vetted and screened appropriately isn't something that a private household does. Before SweepSelf existed, I would never do a background check.
But the Hilton's doing background checks.
Coming to my home. Households don't do that. Like,
no, I mean, but the Hilton's doing it. You're doing it. The Hilton still has theft. How are you avoiding theft in people's homes then?
Well, I don't think I don't think the Hilton has theft. I think they're trying to mitigate against the risk of theft, right? I don't think that the Hilton Hotel South Africa has a higher, much higher rate of theft than, you know, anywhere
but
else,
it's something.
Any other hotel.
So,
but it is relevant. And our premise in starting Sweep South was actually that, yes, we'll do the vetting, we'll do the background checks, but actually, if you treat people well and if you pay them well, they just want to work and earn a decent living for their work. They're not, you know, you don't have people who are inclined naturally to become criminals. Criminality, and my view of the world, is that criminality is a last resort to circumstances and a lack of hope. And so our first defense against that is treating people decently, paying people decently, trying to appeal to customers and the broader public to treat people decently. But as a guarantee, what we do is vetting and background checks.
So much of what you're doing is like good works. That's what everyone's talking about. I'm wondering how much of the business really started that way, because I saw your thought process about starting the business. But before we do, I can't move on without asking about your grandfather and your father. Why wasn't your grandfather here in South Africa?
So as you know, South Africa has a long history of apartheid. And even before that, I think it's an interesting and very unique country, even internationally, in that South Africa has centuries of colonial history, but we were colonized twice. You know, so the Dutch came and then the English came, and for centuries we've had issues with indigenous South Africans not being free, and not being equal in society. And so apartheid was kind of the last, most recent phase of that. And my family, dating back to my great-grandfather, were anti-apartheid activists. So in South Africa, the current ruling party is the ANC, the African National Congress. Before they were the ruling party, they were the opposition to the South African, the undemocratic government in South Africa, or the enforcers of apartheid, the national party here. And my great-grandfather was very before his time, in that he was very outspoken and against it, just on the logic that it doesn't make sense to treat people differently on the basis of race, whatever race they are. He was very, very well educated, especially for a black man in South Africa at the time. I think he was one of the first men to have a law degree in the country, first black man to be awarded a law degree. And him and his son, my grandfather, and in fact my mother, were all anti-apartheid activists who were jailed. In the case of my great-grandfather, my grandfather, they both went on trial, first only father and son to be on trial. And
together.
For the treason trial, a years-long trial that was eventually abandoned because there was no basis for it, but they were tried for treason and ended up leaving the country. And this is why he couldn't come back, and he in fact died in the States, in Washington.
D.C.
That's right.
Yeah. I started tearing up as I read his story. And I'll tell you what, it's partially his story and him, and what suddenly I realized I'm not just in another city. It's also partially, I'm at a point where I'm thinking, what's the meaning of my life? I don't know if you're coming to that. Like, where am I going? What am I doing? And he left such a legacy that frankly, Wikipedia, which was, you know, he knew nothing from Wikipedia. Yeah. It's still marking his life and his existence. When I was in a car and I talked to the driver about who I was interviewing, he didn't know any of the companies that I was talking about, but he knew your mother, who works in the government. Yeah. And then through that jogged his memory about your grandfather. I want to have that kind of impact. Do you feel that?
So that's part of starting Sweep South. It's part of wanting to start my own business. I definitely feel the healthy weight, but the weight of needing to leave a legacy.
From where? Even as a kid, you want to do that?
As a child, I felt it as relevance, like needing to feel relevant. Like I want people to remember me. I want to be interesting.
As a kid. So you grew up in Botswana. You guys were exiled as a family, right? Mm-hmm. Did you feel like, because of my parents, I'm here. What am I doing?
People know my parents. It's not as explicit as that when you're a child. Okay. I recognize that my parents were doing work, or they were people who were remarkable. I recognize that I had a family that was remarkable. I wanted to be remarkable. When I was young, part of that was just, I was interesting as a young black child, in that I was well-educated, well-spoken, confident. And so I stuck out for people. And, you know, I kind of felt like, you know, it's nice to be noticed for people.
And I want more of this.
I want more of this. But later it became, there's a legacy. My family, you know, from every generation, from my great-grandfather dating to my mother, have done something impactful with that responsibility they've been given. I always joke, because my mom is just such a conservative person. She's a politician, but she's so conservative. And she always says, we were given so that we can give. And I always joke with her. I say, you should give a little bit to yourself as well. But that's the way that I was brought up, that you have these gifts, whether it's education, you know, the freedom to do whatever it is that you want, because you should use them for the benefit of humanity. And it sounds cheesy, but coming from the background that I've come from, it's, you know, it's people have done it.
And so you got a PhD, you were working in genetics. You said, I think this can influence a few people, but not enough.
Yeah.
You specifically said genetics is not enough people. I need something bigger. I'm going to go to entrepreneurship.
So it was what I was doing in genetics, and I still find it an absolutely fascinating field. I was working on gene therapy. It's become such a huge space at the moment. But I was thinking about the number of people that a gene therapy for hereditary blindness, which I was studying, would positively impact. And I was thinking about, like, what are the issues that South Africans just face in general, like the ordinary South African. We face such basic issues around unemployment, you know, lack of access to just quality basic healthcare, lack of access to quality education. The fact that despite the fact that apartheid is over, we still have huge inequality in the country, and that leads to hopelessness, people feeling that they don't have an active role to play in growing this country.
And jealousy, I see.
And jealousy, which you can understand.
Yes, 100%. And jealousy that's actually, for once, well-deserved.
Our issue is not, it's not that some people are doing too well. It's that too many people aren't doing
and don't have
well
a chance to.
And don't have the
And so you were feeling, what I want to get at is, you were feeling, I think entrepreneurship can make a difference. Not, you didn't feel it was hokey. You didn't feel it was cliche. You're nodding your head. You're saying, yes, I really believe it.
I didn't really know that it was entrepreneurship. What I started to do was look at different spaces to be in. And I started to read. So I'd read the newspaper with my parents every Sunday. And I started to read the business section of the newspaper, the Sunday papers. And I would just see the movement of these businesses, like, you know, they're like doing this much in revenue and they're hiring this many people and there's a new plant that's being set up. And
right.
It just felt like that's where things are happening.
Right. By the way, I keep checking your mic. If you see, like, why is Andrew a little anxious? I want to make sure that this is coming across right.
Sure.
So that's interesting. When I read about activists, it's always them struggling at these days, struggling and not getting results and almost having this quixotic adventure that makes them feel good but doesn't make progress.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're seeing businesses grow and grow and grow and grow. I know you took a Lyft before you ever heard of Uber when you were in San Francisco. Me too. Something like that. You were watching companies like Lyft and Uber come and get bigger and bigger, and you say, this is the power. I wonder if that popped people's eardrums. This is the power. I think I need to do that.
Yeah, in a sense. What I understood was that my legacy involved people who were responsible for political liberation. My generation needed to be responsible for economic liberation. To do that, you needed to grow industries. What I recognized was that for some reason, and I didn't have much to do with technology. I didn't really understand it that well at the time, but I understood that like these tech businesses, these businesses that are fueled by technology, are growing super fast,
yeah,
and there must be a lot of opportunity there.
Okay, and so then from what I heard, I had your interviews transcribed so that I can read them fast and then go double click and listen to you saying something. Your process for figuring out what business to go to said, I have a few ingredients that I'm looking for. And one of them was a marketplace. Yeah. Why a marketplace?
I like the idea of marketplaces for the potential to be really win-win on both sides. I talk a lot with my co-founders, also my husband, about zero-sum games and, you know, like, why do people think like that? And
why do people think that some things are zero-sum games?
Yeah, well, why do people think in terms of zero-sum games? So you know, a competitive, someone has to lose for someone. And I was just fascinated by this new way of thinking about business where, you know, you can have two sides who are benefiting equally, and it doesn't have to be that one side is predatory.
Okay.
They're also very complex, and I think for better or worse, I'm attracted to complexity and complex problems.
Marketplaces are complex.
They are complex. Okay. They are complex. You always have tension between supply and demand. You always have one side, whichever market you're in or whichever business you're in, that's imbalanced. And so there's always the challenge of trying to find balance on the other side. And there are a whole lot of, you know, other factors that come into play.
I'm looking through my notes here because one of the things that I remember was you had a household helper who quit.
We do. So like many South Africans, we had a household helper. She didn't quit. She was about to go away on holiday. So in South Africa, our seasons are reversed. So December is our summer holidays. And a lot of people, again, because of the legacy of apartheid, so a lot of people working in kind of blue collar jobs in cities, will have their families living in more rural areas outside of those cities. And so over the holidays, whether it's Easter holidays or Christmas holidays, a lot of people will leave the cities and go and spend time with their family for a few weeks. And our helper, our nanny, was about to do this, and she told us that she was going to go away. Often the plans are made at very short notice, and so she told us with a week or two to go and said, look, I'm going away. You need to find a replacement. I'm going to be gone for 4 to 6 weeks. You know, you need to find a step in.
And so you had to do what?
Well, we had to find a replacement because also at the time we were unemployed and trying to figure out business ideas.
You quit just to go do this?
We quit without knowing what we were going to do. So we knew, my husband and I quit our jobs at the same time. By this time I was working as a management consultant, so I'd kind of liked this business thing, but wasn't yet ready to work in my own business. So I went and worked as a management consultant for 2 years for Accenture. And then had quit because I just frankly didn't like being an employee. I didn't like the consulting model of, like, you know, watching and your hours being billed.
And then how much of it was you really saying, I'm having a hard time finding a nanny. This is a problem maybe we could be solving. And how much was it in retrospect looking back and saying, what are some of the things that led to this? I guess this is part of the thought. Let's tell that story.
Combination of both.
Combination. So as you're looking around, what's an idea that you discarded?
So we had this idea for, again, like liking the marketplace type model, we had this idea called Shift South. And in fact, our company still registered as Shift South.
Shift South.
Okay. And the business was a marketplace for tourist activities.
Good thing, like, you didn't do that.
Tourism in South Africa was, it was at the time seen as like one of the driving industries in the country.
Is it not anymore?
But a few things. Less so. Also, when we looked at the numbers of tourists coming into South Africa and as a country and compared them to some European cities, we realized that we're like nowhere near it. And then the other thing was also just, I looked at tourist activities, I looked at tourist activity service providers, and I was like, I don't really, like, it doesn't really resonate with me. I don't really, like, when I go on holiday, I don't go, like, what are the activities that I'm going to, you know, book to make sure that I'm busy during the holiday. So it didn't really resonate on that level.
I get it. I don't either. My wife does. As soon as I said I want to go see a township, she said, Airbnb, let's go to their site. The reason I said it's a good thing you didn't do it, Airbnb is doing that.
Yes, exactly.
And frankly, it doesn't seem like there are that many experiences here. It doesn't seem like there are that many people taking it. So I get that you made the right decision.
Yeah.
Who built the first version of the site?
My husband built it, so he's our CTO. He's an engineer, and he's great. I mean, he really understands when you're faced with the idea of a product or platform. How do you think about the architecture in a way that's relevant for now, but is also able to be scalable if this thing works?
And he coded it from beginning.
Didn't
use a platform, didn't use something else, no.
No, I mean, obviously he, you know, used open source libraries and whatever else, but no.
I went into the source code, as far as I could tell. He didn't use, I thought maybe there's like a marketplace that he used, even for version one.
No, there wasn't at the time, right? So this is, we built it at the end of 2013. And at the time, Uber, so end of 2013, beginning of 2014, at the time, you know, Uber's not internationally recognized. It is just launching in South Africa and in a lot of emerging markets. This idea of platform businesses and apps isn't as well established at all as it is now. And so there weren't these like platforms or frameworks kind of in a box that you could take to build companies like ours.
So you knew we needed this. So he built up the platform. What did you go after first? The workers or the hires?
So going back to, you know, this... The point that I was making around the complexity of marketplaces, you're always going to have one side having the imbalance. And we knew that in South Africa, because of the issues that we face around unemployment, so South Africa's unemployment rates are at about 30% officially.
30% officially.
30% officially, unofficially as high as 40%. Youth unemployment is about 60%.
60% for youth, meaning what?
So 60% of young people in South Africa, 18 to 35 years old, are not employed.
You also said a stat that I can't remember now about what percentage of people are even paying taxes here.
It's a small number. I think it's around 10% in South Africa are paying taxes. So about 5 million people.
That's it.
Just over 5 million in the population.
What happens to the rest of the people who are working? They're just not making enough to pay?
They're not making enough to pay taxes. Or there's a big informal economy, which I think also, I mean, a completely separate conversation, but I think... our unemployment numbers are probably slightly inaccurate because they don't take into account the informal economy, which is a big driver of South Africa's economy, particularly in township areas and informal settlements.
That's a big thing, even in San Francisco, where you go through the nanny hiring process and a big question the nanny will have is, can you pay me under the table?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they don't want to pay taxes.
Yeah.
So you then went after the...
So we knew that... because of the numbers of unemployment, there are women who would be available to and willing to work on the platform while we try and build up a customer base. Initially, we obviously didn't want people to wait until we had enough customers for them to earn a decent living. So we subsidized the first, I would say, probably 10, 20 women who joined the platform.
Meaning you pay them full-time, months. Just be around when we need you, go out there and do the
job
for us, okay?
Yeah.
How'd you find them?
So we, once our own helper came back from holiday, we said to her, you know, we had this experience trying to find someone to step in for you. And, we thought of this idea. We sent out a Google form to a whole lot of our friends and we said, have you experienced something similar? Would you be interested in a service like this? We also asked people what they paid their domestic workers, just to give us a range. And there was so much variability in the range that we also just realized that people... they don't know what they should be paying.
Right.
So when our nanny came back, we said to her, you know, we're building this idea. Would you tell a couple of people in the neighborhood, you know, that your employers are building this business? And she went out and told a few people. And we were just inundated with people. Like
dozens.
Coming in, dozens.
And then how do you pick with them? How do you vet them? What do you do?
So I think like a lot of business owners do in the beginning, everything was very manual, very hands-on, a lot of attention that we paid to like the details of who would be the right type of person to work on the platform. I interviewed every single person who joined for probably the first year or two. And we were running the business out of our house, would invite people to come in. I mean, I would have like queues of people waiting outside the gate every day. Wanting to be interviewed. And we sat down and profiled people. And some of the things that we were looking for were just attitude. You know, everyone had to have experience because that was a prerequisite. We also wanted to help solve unemployment or underemployment with people who had done this type of work before. But it was, you know, it was things like, could you make someone feel comfortable when you first meet them? Are you receptive to this idea of this thing working on your phone? Do you know how to use a phone, a smartphone? Do you know how to use an app? Are you a good communicator? So yeah, the criteria is a little bit different now, but it was very much kind of face to face, just trying to suss out and gauge.
Basically doing the same type of interview process you would if you were doing it for yourself.
That's right.
Not going beyond and doing background checks, or would you?
We did background checks. We used a service then. We now do fingerprint testing in-house, but yeah, we used a service. Where we'd send someone off to go and do the background checks, not in my house.
How'd you find the households that we're hiring?
So a lot of trying to just be inventive about getting the first customers on board. So Facebook also was fairly new in South Africa, at least. And we went onto Facebook and would ask people to ask their friends to use the service. We begged our next door neighbor to use the service.
You did. Just go out, whoever we could get.
Literally whoever we could get. We've got pictures that I still kind of love looking back to, where we would stand at intersections. And so this was in Johannesburg, in South Africa. And we'd stand at traffic intersections and try and hand out flyers to people. And they'd like wind up the window like...
I was going to say, they don't seem like they're looking to talk to people in the street.
No. I mean, I think there's a safety element, but also just, yeah, people, when you're driving, I suppose they aren't really keen to chat.
I was coming back from an Uber, and this guy started shouting something at me and asked for something. So I ran into the hotel, and I said, why am I running? What is he trying to do? But it was a little bit, you know.
Yeah, we are. I mean, I do think our concerns around security make us a little bit more closed off to encounters with strangers.
There are wires on every building. Yeah. Literally wires, electric wires on buildings.
Yeah, that's an interesting place.
I know. Okay, so you had people start to sign up.
Yeah.
You were charging more than they would pay otherwise.
We were. And initially charging more than we are now even. And, you know, we had to kind of adjust pricing to get to that level. That was a slight premium to what households were paying, but not completely out of reach. But yes, we were charging. And that was, you know, it was a very clear aim with the platform, was to try and make sure that people get paid more than the average household is paying domestic workers in the country.
Phone penetration is not high.
Yeah. Smartphone penetration.
Smartphone penetration.
Yeah.
What did you do?
We got contracts to give the first 60 women who joined our platform phones, which was very scary because I was unemployed.
And this was taking your own money.
2-year contracts with our own money. I mean, we didn't have any investment. We had money in the bank, but it was, you know, our savings, retirement plan that we cashed in. We'd sold a whole lot of furniture and stuff. And our car. Yes, so we ended up selling our house.
Wow,
and selling everything.
Did your mom say, what are you doing here? Did she?
My mom did, yeah. I mean, from our parents' point of view, we were two people who were professionals, working professionals, who were earning a salary. I'd studied for 10 years.
Yeah.
And was just, you know, getting into a career and then had resigned from my job, like voluntarily giving everything up. So she thought we were crazy. She actually told me to... She told me to save 3 years' worth of salary before resigning from my job, and I told her that that was virtually impossible.
I get it. It's impossible because you can't do it and do this.
Yeah.
Were you scared?
In starting the business, yes, but also very naive, and thankfully so, because I think if we were aware of all of the challenges that we'd have, and also the fact that you'd have different problems, but it wouldn't become easier as it went along, even as we raise funding. And yeah. So yes, I was scared, probably not as scared as I should have been, which is a good thing. But I think fear is a big part of being an entrepreneur. I think it's part of growing and scaling a business.
But does it help you?
You
were up, you had a baby.
Yeah.
You weren't freaked out? I'm supposed to take care of this baby.
Yeah, but I knew that I had an education. I knew that I, you know, I'd resigned from my job. I hadn't been fired. I knew that I could probably go back to that company or some other company and find work. Worst case scenario. But I also knew that I needed to completely cut the ties and have no, you know, parachute, or not an easy parachute if we were going to jump into this entrepreneurship thing.
You know, the interesting thing is we say burn your boats if you want to really conquer the land, which is a bad thing to say here. But that's what people are saying, burn your boat. But in reality, as I'm doing these interviews, I see lots of examples of people who say, no, I was able to take the big risk because I kept my backup option there.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about people like Matt Mullenweg specifically. I said, aren't you scared starting WordPress? He said, I'm a developer. I could always get a job.
Yeah.
I'm good with it.
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, what I don't like is to be prescriptive, right? So if you say to me, would you advise other entrepreneurs or potential entrepreneurs to do the same thing? I would say do whatever makes sense for you. The reality in South Africa is also that a lot of young Black South Africans like myself, who are lucky to have an education because of the country's history, don't have the, you know, the license to just go, well, my parents sacrificed everything to educate me. I'm now going to go and just, you know, like, just go and start a business which may or may not. Yeah. And I'm just going to gamble with that. And I'm, you know, I'm going to start a business which may or may not fail. So I absolutely think that you've got to do what makes sense for you. In my case, I was 27 at the time. I knew that if things completely crashed, I could probably find a job. I also was fortunate that I had, you know, my parents had a house. So when we sold our home, I could
go live somewhere else. And you lived with your parents?
I lived with my parents for 3 years. I moved out of my parents' home at the beginning of this year, finally.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Was that tough?
No, it was amazing.
What made it amazing?
Just the freedom. I mean, the you know, you again, I feel very, very fortunate and very grateful to my parents. But there's a sense of freedom that you sacrifice when you move home. And I was living in one room with what had now become two kids. And when just before I had the third one, which was at the beginning of this year, my husband and co-founder and myself said we can't be living with
I can't believe you two are still married. I'm looking at your ring to make sure, are they still there together? Is it awkward to ask? Yeah, the ring is still there. You're still there together.
We're still together.
I couldn't work with my wife all day long.
Happy. Yeah.
And live together in a
tight
room.
Again, not prescriptive. Like, just would not recommend it to everyone.
You know, you're making a mistake. Every entrepreneur who's done anything now needs a blog to be prescriptive and tell people here's the way to do it. No,
I don't think that's the way. That's the sure way to set yourself up for failure.
I think so too, or at least to suffer.
Yeah.
Right? Because like every time you make a mistake, you go, ooh, but I just put that Instagram card up with the quote.
Exactly. Exactly. When people go, you told me to do it.
Right. Oh. So you now started to get customers in.
Yeah.
What's the thing that fueled this, that allowed it to really grow and take off?
I think there were two things. The one was the novelty of this experience. Like, so it was the bold who tried it in the beginning. Like I'm going to order a service. I'm going to order a service for someone to come to my home and clean it and do a good job and then leave. And I'll only pay for it afterwards. And it's not a scam. It actually exists.
So that people didn't trust it.
That aha moment of, you know, completing the whole thing, and when the person left and your home was clean and you saw that you hadn't been billed yet, I think that was an amazing experience for people.
Oh.
And then I think what helped us to get lift and to get legs was the fact that people were so wowed by it. Again, the good experience they had, but also just the experience, the fact that you can do this. And people told their friends, and most of our growth was, and actually still is, organic.
The other issue that I heard was transportation, right? How did they get there?
Yeah. So transportation was an issue. We have a big informal public transport system. So
what's it like? What is it?
Use minibus taxis.
Okay.
So these kind of 16-seater taxi buses that, you know, still collect cash from people, and they'll kind of stop anywhere along the road and drop you off. That's a longer route. And the transport infrastructure is set up in a really interesting way in South Africa, because you have these cities that have these hubs that are, so you have these business districts, and then that are surrounded by suburbs that previously catered to white South Africans, and then completely outlying that, and, you know, far away you have informal settlements where people are bused in the morning and bused out in the afternoons. And, you know, as far as possible, that was the thinking from, you know, where suburbia is and where it's nice. But there has to be transport transport to get these people to and from households. And so transport was an issue because that informal public transport system is, informal is probably a nice way to describe it. It is, there's strikes, there are crashes all the time.
They go on strikes?
They go on strikes, yeah. So there's a new bus route that gets set up and that's threatening their routes and they'll strike. Fuel goes up and they'll strike. So there's strikes all the time, crashes all the time because a lot of taxi drivers don't follow road rules. And traffic is terrible. It's really bad. Again, because of inequality, you have a lot of people driving into work in one car, a lot of congestion on roads. And so that was a really tough challenge to try and solve.
So what did you do?
We catered for it a lot with trying to restrict the routes that that sweep stars, so women who work on the platform, would take and how those routes would apply to what homes that they'd work in. We came up with average times, so to get from this point, which is something that didn't exist before.
You can't. You had to put that into your market, into
your
platform.
We had to factor that into our algorithms where we looked at, are you able to work in this area and arrive by this time?
And it's a full day job, what we're looking at,
it's,
for the most
it's,
part.
It's, so the average booking time is between 5 and 6 hours.
Okay.
Previously it was, you go in the morning to your employer and you leave at the end of the day. That's it. But we work on a per hour basis, so
you can might
book
actually move
3, 4, 5 hours. It's completely.
I'm so excited about your business. I keep interrupting. I'm sorry. So you might have to actually move someone from one employer to another and factor that in too.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Time of day, area, traffic.
All of this.
All of that.
This is your co-founder doing the whole thing?
So by that point, we were able to do those sorts of manipulations around the matching algorithms. We now had a dev team who were able to help. But initially, yes, it was him and I. I mean, I remember sitting and trying to work out the maths in the beginning and questioning a lot of our assumptions. So we thought, you know, we're going to work out the algorithms based on the radius of, from like getting to this, from this point to that point. This is the distance. Then they should be able to work. And it didn't work like that. It was, no, there's a taxi route. That taxi route has this many stops on average. This is the time of day. You know, some routes would have 2 or 3 taxis, so you'd have to get out of one and then get onto another one. So it was a lot more complicated than we initially thought.
They don't have APIs.
They're no.
You're not looking into their APIs. Wow.
Very far from APIs.
The first funding came from where?
Our first funding came from a South African angel investor, a guy called Vinnie Lingham.
Who's he?
So he's actually now based in San Francisco, and he started companies in South Africa initially before moving overseas. And he was judging a startup pitching competition that we went and pitched at. And the aim of that pitch was to try and launch in a different city. So we were in Joburg, we went to Cape Town, we went to this pitching competition, and we pitched and, you know, just thought that we could get some customers from the audience of this you know, pitching competition, tech conferencing. And Vinny was one of the judges, and he came to us afterwards and he said, I really love your guys' idea. I loved your pitch. Are you interested in an investment? And we said yes. And we had absolutely no idea what to ask him for. You know,
you weren't studying startups.
We were. I mean, we'd read up quite a bit, but I think we weren't prepared, and we hadn't expected that encounter to result in an investment opportunity.
So then who'd you talk to understand what to do?
I mean, him, and I wouldn't advise other founders to do this. Like, have your first investor be the person who gives you advice as well. But I think he was kind of judicious enough to understand that the scene was so early, and also that he was trying to get into the investment space, that he should probably be fair in the way that he thought about the business.
Was he fair in retrospect?
I would say fair, but assertive,
okay.
Aggressive, not aggressive in his approach, but an aggressive
with the numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
How much did he put in?
I think he put in about maybe 200,000 rand.
Okay.
What's
the number? I have such a hard time doing this math. It's because it's not like an easy like straight number. And
yeah,
it seems
and
to change
and
a
it
lot.
Also keeps on changing. So I don't know where the exchange rate is. Like, are you doing 15?
Under $15,000. And that's a lot here.
It's enough to get a business off the ground. We had...
No, I mean, that's a lot for him to invest because that's nothing.
It wasn't a lot for him to invest. I don't think. I think it was enough for us to get to the next stage of where the business needed to be. He also helped us bring on other investors. So we ended up raising, I think, about 600,000 Rand during that round. So what's that? Like
45,000. Roughly 50,000.
Yeah, 45,000.
Fair to say that if there's anyone who's listening who's in a situation like this where they're trying to raise money in, let's say, South Africa, they should contact you, they should contact Amy, Mark, somebody who's done it before and said, hey, is this guy make sense?
Yeah.
These numbers.
And it did make sense at the time. We were 4 months into the business when we met him, probably about 6-7 months when we closed the investment with him, and then he subsequently brought on one or two others. Things have also changed. But I definitely, you've got to get advice. You have to get advice before getting your first investor on board.
And if you're about to raise money, it opens up doors with other entrepreneurs who've raised money, right?
Yes.
It makes it easier to have a conversation. I'm looking him up, by the way, as you can see here on my iPad as we're talking. He's impressive.
Yeah, so he's done really well. I mean, he started in South Africa with Yola, and then he sold a company called Gift. He's very into the blockchain space at the moment with Civic.
And he's born here.
He's born here, in fact, born in the Eastern Cape in South Africa. Hmm. And he's been a big champion for the startup space in South Africa and in Cape Town in particular. So he was one of the founders of an organization called Silicon Cape, who were trying to set up a Silicon Valley type ecosystem in Cape Town.
Okay.
And, you know, that's why I say that I think he was assertive and aggressive with the numbers, but fair. And we have a great relationship with him now. We were recently in LA, and he came to visit us. He's staying in San Diego. He came to come and visit us and just catch up.
I really admire everything I'm reading about him. I think he shouldn't call it Silicon Cape, because there's no silicon in Silicon Valley anymore. You're just copying blindly and changing. It's got to be, here's our new thing. Yeah. We are this, and it has a brand new
name,
right?
Yeah, 100%. And we do things differently. We've got our own set of values and our unique take. So we've got Silicon Cape, Silicon Coast, Silicon Savannah.
Every country I go to has a silicon something. Yeah. And I feel like they should all get rid of silicon and say, we obviously are duplicating, like my younger son copying his older brother without recognizing what matters and what doesn't.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't reflect well.
Yeah.
All right. But what he's doing is impressive. And man, I would freaking love to interview him. Who knew that he's in Palo Alto right now? Or at least according to Wikipedia. You can never tell with Wikipedia. So you started raising money that allowed you to invest more in developers. What about in marketing? What did you do differently?
So we had absolutely no idea initially how to market like a digital business, like an online platform. And I think that was probably a good thing, because we started off doing what we could do ourselves, and that allowed us to learn a lot about the product, about what works, what didn't work, and to interact a lot with our initial customers. Whereas if we had started off and put a crap load of money
into an agency, we wouldn't have understood it.
We wouldn't have understood it, and we wouldn't have had that immediate kind of feedback as operators in the business.
So what are some of the bad ideas that you had for marketing? It was standing out on the street. That didn't work, right?
That did not work.
But it does get good photos that really shows we are putting the effort in.
Yeah,
thanks for a nice story. Those kids of yours are going to see that forever.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Mom and Dad stood in the middle of the street. Now they expect us to stand in the middle of the street. We don't want to. Oh, yeah. Okay, but you did
that. Which I don't think is necessarily a bad marketing strategy. It was not the right usage of our time. But again, you know, we knew something from doing that. So, like, not a good idea at that stage of business. So what did we... Other things that we did not do well. So we tried to do Facebook marketing ourselves without understanding it. And I think it's one of those things like paid SEM, where you can spend a lot of money making a lot of bad decisions if you don't know what you're doing. But the flip side of it is that, again, like we really were able to get feedback from people, to interact with customers and get feedback on what they liked about the company, what they didn't like. We developed a brand identity. Our first Facebook ads were really revolting, like really, really bad. A lot of stock photos.
In your Facebook ads?
Oh, yeah. A lot of stock photos. A lot of sinning, brand sins.
Like what?
Brand
sin?
Yeah, like sinning, as in, you know, like
making a mistake.
Bad, yeah.
What did you do that was bad for your brand?
I mean, we would use different colors on every ad. We would, our first logo was a clip art picture that I think someone pointed out, like at a later stage. They were like, oh, I've seen this before, like on some icon on my computer. But I think that's fine in the early days. That shouldn't be the focus of what your company is about. I think the most important thing is, do you have a product that people absolutely love using and want to tell other people to use and will give you feedback on and will pay for? And we did, and that was what was important.
Speaking of, I sent a message to the founder of Mapbox. I know him because we lived in DC. He's got this map software that's doing phenomenally well. I sent him a note. I said, look, we're friends. Our families are friends. You copied Buffer's logo completely in your thing. He emails me back. He goes, something like, LOL, this is a common icon. And he showed me where, and I go, oh, Buffer, when they were starting out on social media, they might have just copied this thing.
It is a very simple logo, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. You know, it's just a stack of three squares, or four squares or something like that. So I guess you're right. It doesn't really matter. Just get started. You do it.
Yeah.
Put that on your Twitter feed. Get started and do it. It doesn't you got to be an influencer. It's not enough to just be an entrepreneur.
I know. Watch those followers. You don't have enough followers yet.
Right. What did work when you were doing it yourself?
Marketing or everything?
Marketing. Or, you know what? Let's start marketing, but anything else?
What did work is understanding how people found this service before we existed. And using that as the way to try and acquire customers.
Oh, they found Household Help before this existed, before they could go to Sweep South.
Yes.
What did they do?
So instead of going, we are the competition to classified listings. We are the competition to Facebook. We went, that's how people are talking about these services and are finding people. Let's go onto there and make sure that they're talking about Sweep South.
So if they're going to classifieds, don't say we're better than classifieds because we vet and all that. Say, all right, let's go to classifieds.
Absolutely.
So you bought classified ads. What else did you do?
We bought classified ads. We spoke to all of our friends on Facebook, but also went into neighborhood groups, as many as we could without getting blocked.
On Facebook.
Okay. And said, and both said, hey, we're a service that does this. But also if someone was asking for it, we would just say, hey, there's this thing, Sweeps Off. Like, you know, you should go.
And this was you personally sitting there doing it.
And that was us personally. Very, very hands-on, not scalable, but it worked. The other thing that we did was one of our, which worked and I think is just the smart thing to do in general, is we realized that we were probably giving our early investors a cheap deal. So we were like, well, what have these guys done before and how do we use them? So instead of hiring a head of marketing for the first few months, we said to them, look, guys, like you've invested into the business. We've built the platform. You know, we need you guys to use whatever, you know, skills that you use in building
go
your own
marketer.
Business to go and help us. And
so who was sitting there marketing for you?
So Vinny's partner, Lou Clarkson, actually helped set up a lot of our very early marketing campaigns. So together...
In Facebook?
They ran on Facebook and on search.
Okay.
So a lot of our Google campaigns he set up. And then it obviously got to a point where we needed someone who did this as, you know, their main job and had the time and skills. But I think you should, especially in the early days, like leverage off of your networks in general, and investors are part of that network. And, you know, later stage, it's strategic and it might be networks or whatever, but very early stage, I think you shouldn't be shy to ask them to get involved operationally.
And I bet they want to be involved.
Well, they want you to do well, and they've, you know, if they've got skills that they can help you with, there isn't a reason they should do it. And also, you're probably so bad at it that, like, your 10 hours as a founder doing that is probably, you know, an hour or two to them with the same end result.
Also, Mark from WooCommerce and I were talking, and he said he's making some investments, but it's also very passive. He's like, he's someone who's a builder, who's a worker. It's hard for him.
Yeah.
It's kind of like for us as parents, sometimes you just want to say, no, you could just put that puzzle piece right there.
Yes.
Just include me in the puzzle. No.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm looking you up on Ahrefs to get a sense of like how content marketing is going for you. You're not doing content marketing at all. Or not, I shouldn't say at all. You're not doing big, are you doing big content marketing? Do you know
this?
Because your top pages here look like it's, okay, so we go into the apply page that's really big and all that. What is this road?
Okay, so it's a lot of...
Roadport?
Oh, Roadport, that's an area.
Okay, got it. So it's these it's these area pages.
Yeah, so we've set up these kind of pages that are location specific for SEO purposes. But
that I noticed. Yeah. That I saw. Ahrefs is saying they're not valuable enough. You're not doing enough to do the key to target the keywords on it. That's fairly decent. Usually, I'll see like way higher value pages right here.
Yeah.
I think Ahrefs.
Get back to our
marketing. My username and password? No, I shouldn't give my username and password on them. I wish I could sometimes just go, hey, founder, here's my username and password on all these services I use. Go look yourself up. You're going to be shocked. Go look up your competition. You'll be shocked by what they're doing. So is SEO big for you guys?
It is. We could do it better. We could do better. We've recently... brought on someone to look at both our paid and organic and unpaid as a specific function. So
I was searching to see, can I actually can I go to .co.za for your domain and
you
maybe that's the big
to.
One.
Should
I can't
then
it redirects to .com.
Yeah.
Which tells me you have bigger plans.
Yeah.
Right? If you're thinking beyond the South African top level domain, you really want to go, you want to even go to the US, don't you?
Yeah, so the US maybe, definitely emerging markets. We bought the .com before we bought the .co.za, and I think it speaks to that. I think we recognized that this is probably a problem that a lot of people face around the world, and where we wanted to specifically tackle it is where there are the issues around unemployment, around unequal societies, where there's high growth of middle class or middle income populations. So not necessarily the sort of like very mature markets like the US and like Europe, but I think the benefit of a lot of the markets that we're looking at are that the usage of these sorts of services are very frequent. And so, you know, Sweepsouth is actually, it's not an on-demand business. It's a subscription business. It's a recurring business.
Yeah,
it's the way that you find out about us may be because you're looking for someone, you know, once or for, or ad hoc or temporarily. But the majority of our customers become long-term recurring customers.
What's the biggest challenge? What's the one that was almost destroying the company?
I mean, I don't think we've faced a challenge that has been an existential challenge. I think we felt like that's been the case a few times. There have been a couple of times where we've just been completely thrown off by the kind of number of customers who've come in, and we've had this kind of surge of customers that we didn't plan for, and our response to that has not always been great. And you know, we've kind of then thought like, okay, this is the end. The business is over. But I think an ongoing challenge for us, and what keeps me up at night, is the demand side of the business and making sure that we're able to access enough new customers at a sustainable cost to be able to grow the business. And the bigger you become, the harder that becomes. Like, you know, it's easy to go out and physically beg 5 customers to use your business, but you know, when you're trying to get thousands more to sign on in the previous month, that
what's
becomes
the market
more difficult.
Size here for you? How many do you think? How many households can afford you?
So South Africa has about 14 million households, but you know, that tax number that we talked about is quite telling about South Africa's inequality. And so when I think about the number, the addressable market in terms of the number of households, it's probably closer to various types of usage, but probably closer to around 4 to 5 million, which is why we started to think about expansion outside of the country. We've thought about these different verticals that we need to get into. Because compared to the States and a lot of European countries, it's a relatively small market.
And so the other verticals you got into are?
So we've just launched a platform called Sweepsouth Connect. It's an on-demand platform, very, very new, and I can see you searching.
I'm uncomfortable by how much you can see that I'm searching as we're talking.
So Sweepstart Connect is it's a more on-demand based platform that connects people with handymen, plumbers, electricians. And the idea is that Sweepstart is a relationship-based platform where there's a strong recurring nature to it. With Connect, it's I need someone to come in just this once.
Fix my toilet, that's it.
That's it.
It's a problem.
Across a range of different services. So, you know, the volume there is that we are offering, we started with 6, but, you know, it will be hundreds of different services.
But it's not like Thumbtack in the US, which sells leads. It's you are matchmaking.
So it's similar to Thumbtack in that it's more marketplace driven than Sweepstart is. Sweepstart cleaning business. The revenue model is different. So it's taking a commission off of
the work that they do.
The work that gets done.
But are you sending the leads to a few people, or I as the customer get to pick?
So both. So we present you with a number of leads who've responded real time, but we also allow you to browse leads. So it works both ways.
Okay.
So instead of just, you know, you being served this number of people, you can also go, okay, in the area that I'm in at the moment, there are whatever 20 people who do this. They haven't necessarily responded to me. I can ping them and check whether they're willing to do this job.
Sweepstart started with a website, and I read older articles where you said the phone app is coming soon.
Yeah.
This is going the other way.
Yeah.
Because what's happening to the market? Do you find that the people who you're working with are mostly on phones or desktops?
So we have a very interesting usage pattern where people are coming to us. The first time users will come in through the web. They'll often make their first booking on the web and then post that they'll download the app and then use the app for management. So you know, to change bookings, to make subsequent bookings. So that's been quite interesting. And the reason for doing it the other way around with Connect is that this is a lot more location-based. So I'm booking a service to come and clean at my home. It's more likely that I'm going to be at home when the geyser bursts or the toilet gets clogged or whatever. And it's easier for me to just go, I need someone at the spot that I'm at right now.
But I think ahead of time for that.
It depends. So
no, I mean to go download the app. Or you're saying, look, I have a problem. This thing happened. I go to the site. The site says, download the app. I go, okay, fine. I'll download the app. Got it. And all right. And then there's another part of your business where you're selling things too.
Yeah.
What are you selling?
So we're selling a range of home products. We've partnered with Reckitt Benckiser, who are a big international German brand who make a range of home cleaning products. And the idea is that these products will partner the services. So the shop is catering to Sweepstart, the cleaning business, but eventually it'll cater to Connect and whatever services are available through Connect as well.
And the reason is that it's the same households who are hiring people who are going to also be buying this. Is that the idea? That's it. And it's them buying it for the people who they're hiring.
Well, they're buying it for themselves, for the people who they're hiring to clean the house.
Got it.
Yeah. So an example is I obviously use Sweepstart myself at home, and on Friday, our Sweepstart came to the house and she said, I'd left a note for you to get cleaning stuff, to get washing powder. And I hadn't seen the note. I hadn't gone to get anything. And now she's arrived at the house and needs to do laundry, but they
don't have it.
Supplies. And so the idea is that she should ultimately be able to order those things through the app herself.
Can she do it now?
Not now,
but...
But the idea is that we get to that point. But prior to that, it's that you can just order via the shop. And
I read that's the vision. So yes, hire more employment. And for the customer, they should have a person cleaning their house with... Oh, I forget how you put it. You put it so beautifully somewhere. It was like this magical dream. Of course I want it, which is...
Well, it's total home management.
Like, right, you want them to manage the home.
Is to be able to have someone able to manage all of those things for you that you forget. I have 3 kids. I'm always running out of stuff.
Like milk. Like you want the person to be able to go buy the milk, the same one that the customer would buy if exactly. they were doing it themselves.
Exactly.
But we're saving them
because
time.
Because they know exactly what milk you use because they open your fridge to clean it.
And it just occurred to me, the only way that they're going to know it is if they get the ability to start picking it up themselves so that when they leave because they're going on holiday because it's middle of summer in December, the next person will know through Sweep South,
exactly.
this is what the family likes. Exactly. They like whole milk, not...
Exactly.
That's the vision.
Exactly.
But yeah. it was kind of awkward. I was looking up your dad as we were talking because you mentioned
him. Oh, that's my grandfather.
John. That is your grandfather.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Your father's still alive?
My father's still alive. Still
What's
married
he thinking?
My mother. So my mother is the daughter of Joe Matthews, granddaughter of ZK Matthews.
Ah, okay. Okay. So that was, wait, this was your grandfather. This was your great grandfather that, which Zed, as you say, or ZK Matthews is your
That's right. Is my great grandfather.
Joe Matthews
son
is your,
is my grandfather.
Got it.
And my mother is, Naledi Pandor, but formerly
Got
Naledi
it.
Matthews.
Wow. Yeah. I did a bunch of looking up on your family and I had it wrong. Your dad proud of you? Your mom proud of you now?
I think so. I think they've always been proud of me. I've always worked hard.
But it's not enough. I see
it's not
guys.
Enough for me.
It's not, but for
it's
them, is it
it's enough for them. They're,
like
no,
you,
they're
you're,
great.
You're good?
They're great. Yeah, they're great. I think, I mean, so my parents are, they're kind of old school in the sense that like working hard and earning a decent, honest income for them is, you know, that's, like that you're doing well. And then, you know, as I said, being able to have work that has purpose where you're serving other people for them is like, you know.
And they're good. They're proud of it.
Really like yeah, they were not initially, not proud of me. I think they've always been proud of me, not happy when I resigned from my job. They also, I think, didn't properly understand what we were trying to do with Sweep South. You know, they thought that I left my degree and then my consulting work, which were both very respectable things to be doing to start a cleaning company. But they're very proud of myself and Alan, my husband and co-founder who they love. They're proud of the work that we're doing and the impact that we have on people. And I think are proud of the fact that we said to them that this is something we wanted to do and 5 years later, we're doing it.
Yeah, I bet. Do you think the little girl who was 8 years old in Botswana would feel this is good, it turned out all right?
I think so. There's a lot more that I want to do.
Every time I'm looking for like a high end, we're like, yes, we did it. I look in your eyes and I see almost like a parent who says, oh, you got 98%. What happened to the other 2%? Like, I feel like you came from an upbringing of you're good. I'm not telling you're a broken person. You could do better. You're meant to get 100%. And then there's a kid behind you who should get 67 instead of 64.
You know what it is? It's, it's, you know, that saying standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
When I think about what my ancestors have done, it's just like, you know, and again, I think we've done a great job so far, but it pales in comparison. So I think there's more to do. I'm also young, you know, and I have to kind of give myself that I'm still pretty young. I'm 34. And I hopefully have, you know, a lot more years ahead of me. But there's a lot more that I want to do.
Yeah.
And I think a lot more until I feel fulfilled or I feel like, I'm creating a legacy.
Yeah. Well, you're on your way. I don't know if I'm on my way yet. Came here to do a marathon. I'm running a marathon on every continent.
Okay, that's amazing. Jeez.
26.2 miles to think about it and to think about the pain of running in Africa. That was the hardest of all the continents because it was so hot. The ground was hard. And I felt like, I'm going to figure it out on one of these runs, but I haven't yet. I've got one last continent.
You'll get there.
I think I'm doing good work, but I also want to do more. This, I don't know. Sometimes I envy people who just are happy with whatever they have, whatever they're doing.
I agree, and I mean, I'm saying this as that exact same person, right? So I totally get it. But I think the fact that you feel that means that you're probably going to get there. I think also when, you know, it's so this sense of not being satisfied and of wanting to do more, it's something that drives me. But also, if I had to sit right now and go like, okay, this is it, this is the end, I would feel very satisfied and happy with what I've achieved now. So that sense of it's not enough is because I know that I have more time and I want to do more with that time. And I hope you feel the same.
I do. Sometimes I do feel like, oh, I'm really liking being with the kids. What if I just go run all day, hang out with the kids? I've done enough. I think I won't feel like every box has been crossed off, yeah, but I'll feel very happy. And that actually comes from just figuring out how to be happy myself, you know?
Yeah.
All right. It has been great to get to know you. Thank you for not feeling awkward about all the like stuff that I have on my screen about your family, about like how much money. What did I look over here? Oh, yeah. Service fee. This is how you guys make money? The service fee?
So we take a commission off of the booking fee on the platform.
Oh, I know what it was. This is nothing. This costs so little money. That's what it was. I was looking to see how much it would cost to have somebody come to my house. It's, let me see. For 5.5 hours, it's...
So it's like not even $20. So in developed economies, it's 5 to 10 times more expensive to have this service. I think it speaks to South Africa and the makeup of the economy. I think the legacy of apartheid. Labor is unfortunately cheap, and what we've got to do as a country, and one of our biggest challenges, is going to be how to educate people so that the majority of our country aren't lowly skilled or semi-skilled laborers. We have 1 million domestic workers in South Africa for a population of 55 million or whatever it is. 2% of our population are domestic workers earning a couple of thousand rands a month. How do you lift that sort of population into, we talk about the fourth industrial revolution, how do you lift up an economy that's based on that sort of labor into being able to be competitive with the sort of things that are happening internationally?
Do you think it's them or do you think it's their kids?
Well, I don't think it's going to be, it's not necessarily going to be the people who grew up going to school under, the apartheid system, but also a large number of women who work on our platform are young. 60% of women on our platform are youth. So
there is still
there's opportunity.
All right. I'm in awe of what you did. I'm so honored that you came on here. The website for anyone who wants to check it out, it's sweepsouth.com. Aisha, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's been great to chat.